Welcome to another show. I'm TJ Ryan, and my guest this week is Steve Becco from Vancouver, Canada. Steve is the host of a website called Golden Age of Gaia. He also writes a lot of articles and books, and so he's been on the show once before, and I just recently sent him an email, and we tried to hook up yesterday, but we had some technical difficulties, but he's back today. He's back with us today from Vancouver, Canada. Nice to have you on board. How are you doing, Steve?
Hi. I'm doing very well, TJ. I'm happy to be back. We usually have a wonderful conversation, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is the third time.
How are you?
I'm great. This is the third time we've chatted. We talked privately before, and then we did the show, and now we're back for a third time. And I'm just, you know, I'm always connected to what you're doing, and so much of it rings true to me. Do you have any idea how many people you reach with your website or communicate with?
I believe it's between 10 and 20,000 hits a day.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. You started this back when? 2009?
Yes, September 27, 2009. I've been sick, and I could no longer run the discussion group that I had been running, which was called Galactic Roundtable. And so I need to do something while being sick. So I thought, well, I'll open up a blog. Mm-hmm. And having no idea what a blog was.
Right.
Anyways, yes.
And so you started that 10 years ago. And at the time, nobody's listening. How did you get all these people coming on board?
Well, it wasn't quite true that nobody was listening, because the members of the Galactic Roundtable discussion group would read the blog. And so I kind of started out with a little bit of a base. How did it grow? Well, what Michael tells me is that he brings people to the blog.
Oh. So, well, there you go.
So that's...
And you
that's
have...
Go ahead.
And you have this connection with Archangel Michael. How long has that been around? How long have you been connected?
That started in, it's actually a very interesting story. In 2010, November, I think, I had a lucid dream. And I saw a woman about 200 yards from me. And for some reason, I felt magnetically attracted to her, right? And I just rushed towards her, and she rushed towards me, and we embraced, and I woke up. I said, Who was that? Who was that woman? And my friend Len was having readings with Linda Dillon, and I'd been listening to his readings. And I said to myself, my gosh, I got to go have a reading. And the first reading was with that woman, who turns out to be Anna Stara, who is my twin flame, and also my head guide. And she told me all about my guides and what I'd be doing and how I have been doing. It was very, very interesting. And I said, well, I think I need another reading. I need a second reading. So that was arranged for about, I think, January 5th. And when Linda got on the call, she said, I think there's somebody here who wants to talk to you. And it turned out to be Archangel Michael. And he said, you know, we've traveled for eons, and you've come here to be a communicator. And he then outlined what I was to do, past lives, all kinds of things. And for about the next 3 months, it was informational, right? He was just kind of bringing me up to speed. And then it became the world scene and advice for all light workers, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of grew and widened. It's been wonderful. It's just been the most rewarding circumstance of my life. And
I was just going to say, was there ever a time, Steve, when you first heard it, where you thought, I don't know if I believe this. Is this for real? Were there ever any doubts early on?
Oh, yeah, no, there have been doubts from time to time. There have also been things which I regard as tests from time to time.
Right.
I'll give you an example, and not only tests of me, but tests of light workers as well. He would give an explanation that wasn't going to be popular, right? And then he'd wait for about 3 minutes into the talk to say something which utterly explained what he meant before. And it was almost like, you know, a light worker reading that would get incensed by what he said up top and, you know, be with that and talk to themselves and do all this kind of thing. And then later they would come upon the sense that explains it all. And it's like he just wanted to bring up our issues, right? Mm. Because they do want us to bring up our issues and be free from them. But then there are also experiences that I've had with him that are positively evidential, you know, positively, I was going to say probative, I'm using legal language, proof. You know, they proved that he was who he said he was. And so on balance, no, I absolutely buy what is happening. But there have been ups and downs.
It's hard to hold the faith, like some of your more recent blogs have talked about. Keep that faith when everything seems to be going. Maybe there's things not happening as quickly, I think, as a lot of people are hoping that they're going to be happening. And that's what I noticed recently on some of the articles on Golden Age of Gaia. And I also noticed that you kind of take a little bit of a hit on that stuff. Sometimes people get a little upset with some of the stuff you say. How does that make you feel when you get that?
Well, I regard that as practice, you know, as toughening up. In the future, I'm going to be working with the Galactics, and I'm going to be, I guess you could say, translating what they say, or even lending a second voice to what they say to us, to terrestrials, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to need to have a little tougher skin than I do. I don't know if you noticed that even some of the editors on the blog are not agreeing with me, right?
Yep.
And that's fine. You know, I don't need for it to be some kind of, you know, controlled forum where you have to toe a party line or something like that. So I'm okay with that.
I think, as an observation,
appreciate where people are at.
As an observation from somebody who sees all of it like that, I think it's good that people don't always agree. And I think it's also good that you're challenged, because nothing is going to move us forward if we're not challenged. And how we choose to react to an incident is totally on us. And words only have power if we allow them. And of course, I tell myself that again and again, but it doesn't always work. But I'm saying that words only have power. And so it's always a lesson, I think, when somebody does challenge, to move to that place where we detach and allow ourselves to be more free from the power of those words that we feel may hurt us in some way.
Yes.
Or we take ownership of it and we need to let go of all of it. So that's, when I read that, that's what I take away. I look at it, well, okay, this, if this was me, how would I react to that? So.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that you raise this particular question, because my partner, Kathleen, is doing a lot of work on issues as well, and she is taking the point of view that what she'd like to do is to remain in the center with whatever is said, to remain in balance, and she uses forgiveness, compassion, and gratitude to achieve that, right? Mm-hmm. And she's, I would say she's a lot farther down the road than I am with what the work I've been doing on issues or bossness. But I always have it in the back of my mind that the place to come from is the center, is balance. So, as you say, it's a challenge to find and keep that center.
It's easy.
Which is going to be so necessary later.
Yes, I think it's easy when you're in a state of love and grace and everything feels great. But there are days, you know, where, like in my job, I've got a lot going on. There's a lot of stress. I don't get upset, but it's just easier for me, I know, when I'm got time off and I've got no cares in the world, and then everything is wonderful and joyful, and people would say, you know what, I just burned your house down. And that's great. You know, it's different.
New house.
Yeah, it's different when you're, I think there's, it's just different situations. Plus, there's different energies where I, you know, where I work at, and it's completely different compared to where I'm at, when I'm at home. So I think there's a lot of things that can play into it. And I think also where people live, don't you feel like locations on the planet have different energies that can affect all of us?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And not only that, but I'm so fortunate to have an apartment that looks out over English Bay in Vancouver, which is just a beautiful sight. I mean, mountains in the background and the ocean and what have you. That also affects your, you know, your mindset and your feeling state. But and yes, also the environment. I mean, this is a, I'm truly blessed in this environment. It's peaceful, you know, there's not, nobody's doing anything to anybody else very much in this city. And it would be a lot harder if, say, I was in New York City or Washington, D.C. or something. That would be very difficult.
I think
so, yeah.
And where I live, it's pretty sparse. It's north of Green Bay, right on Lake Michigan. Actually, I live about 15 minutes out of town, so I live way out in the country. And so it's so peaceful. I get home, and it's really, the town I'm working out of is about 13,000 people. So it's not like it's really hustle and bustle. A big city.
Yeah.
It's small town. Yeah. And then when I drive home, you know, 15-minute ride. And then when I park in my yard, it's totally nature. And I'm at peace the minute I pull in the driveway. So.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. That definitely helps.
Now, the ride home is different with all the people cutting me off, you know. No, it's
not. I saw you on YouTube the other day, didn't I? You were the failed driver, the road rage.
Maybe that was me. So, but, I think environment makes such a difference. If I was in a major city, I don't know. I guess it depends where I'd be at, if I'd be happy. To me, just happiness comes so easy, much easier to come when you can be in nature and walk in it every, you know, in a moment's notice. Seems to make a huge difference. You wanted to talk.
Well, actually,
go ahead.
Just before we leave that, too, I look out over the bay, right? And the city is behind me, and it's as if I don't see the city. All I see is the bay. And then about 5-10 minutes walk from here is Stanley Park, which is huge. It's rather like Central Park. And so nature is right there. So you can even find these niches in the city, but not easy to come across. What were you going to ask, DJ?
I know when we talked before we were going to do the interview, you had mentioned about talking about love. And first of all, I guess, you know, because you hear the term so many different times, different said different ways. Mm-hmm. What is your definition of the word love?
Whoa, I don't think you can define love, can you? Wow, boy, oh boy, oh boy. Wow. Well, let's see. A definition tells what something is and what something isn't. Well, it's not. There are different forms of love, right? There are different levels of love. When I use the word love, the one I'm talking about is either a fifth dimensional to seventh dimensional love. And I say that because that's what Michael and the Arcturians have told me about my experiences of love, right? I've asked them, they said, well, that's fifth dimensional, well, that's seventh dimensional. So I'm talking about that, and I'm not talking about what we ordinarily think of as love,
right?
Like love between two people, love between a mother and or a father and the child, love between friends, you know, not talking about anything like that. If this other form of love, this higher dimensional love, is totally different.
Right.
totally different. The main difference, I'm getting around to the definition, kind of working up to it. The main difference is that in my ordinary state of love, so I'm feeling love, and then I have a thought like, oh my God, I don't have enough money to get through the end of the month, or, oh my God, this person has done that to me. And either I feel fear, or I feel anger, and the love disappears.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Now I feel afraid or angry. When you're in this higher dimensional form of love, which I started out calling transformative love, because it transforms the circumstances. It doesn't yield to the circumstances. Right.
Right.
So fear and anger can't get near it. It's like it's sounds kind of silly, but it'd be as if you have a 50-foot rubber tire around you and nothing can get near you.
Right. A little right? bubble.
It's that impervious to these lower states. Now, having said that as prelude, and knowing that I'm only talking about that kind of love, I define it as an infinitely deepening state in which one feels totally at peace with the world, totally satisfied, totally rewarded, as if there's nothing left to do except share this love, because love flows, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't allow it to flow, then it disappears, right? Love, this higher dimensional love is a flow. Linda's described it as a tsunami of love. Mm-hmm. And that is a very apt description.
Absolutely.
When I had my heart opening in 2015, I came into this inner tsunami of love, and it absolutely swept me away. So that's not a bad description of it at all.
No.
So that's how I define it. What it's not, ordinary love, and what it is, it's supremely deepening, eternally, infinitely deepening state, which just gets better and better, and sweeps away all concerns. And no concern can reach me when I'm in that state.
And that is the more natural state that we are as beings.
It is, because I've also had an experience of the self, and of peace. Like, I'm talking again, not an ordinary experience of peace that we have in our normal state, but a much, much deeper state of peace. And they all, when I had my experience of the self, they were all a part of that. They were all contained in that. The self is peace. The self is love. The self is bliss. So yes, it is our natural state. In fact, if I could say this, ascension itself corresponds with a state of enlightenment, and that state is called Sahaja Samadhi, and it is a full permanent heart opening. Like, it is the same as the junior experience I had, but eternal, right? The word Sahaja means natural. So all of this, all that we're doing, is sending us in the direction of our natural self. We're getting back to nature. We're getting back to our natural self. It's kind of funny when you think of that. It's like we're divesting ourselves of stuff,
right,
that sits on top of the natural self.
Yeah. It's been so buried away, and for many different reasons, I believe. I mean, our bodies, our DNA has been manipulated. So we don't have that ability to have the consciousness, the full consciousness, I think. And if we were in that state, then we could probably feel that love all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also by coming into a physical world, people say that we lowered our vibrations, and it's hard for us maybe to be completely connected to the higher self or to God or source or whatever. Part of it's right. that reason as well. So,
yes.
But like the love you talk about, the bliss, the joy, and I know the last time
yes.
we talked, I shared with you about both my parents
yes,
coming
did.
Back. And so, to me, if you've never felt that, then maybe it's, if
yes.
I didn't feel that before, maybe I wouldn't know what you're talking about. But to me,
yes.
it's that pure joy and bliss.
Yes.
And to me, this is that higher love that exists. And it's just so welcoming. And there's no
yes.
judgment, and it's just pure acceptance and pure joy. You don't want to leave it. It's like being in a nirvana, a state of nirvana, where you just don't want to leave that. It's like...
Yeah, nirvana is just deeper. Nirvana is just a deeper experience of that very same love that you're talking about. Yes, I agree.
And so that's what
Sorry.
You want. Well, you're anytime. You can cut me off anytime you want, Steve.
no.
But the thing is, this is what we want to bring forward, right? So we're defining it. How do we go forward if people have never experienced that before? What do they do to maybe feel that?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that. But just before we leave the last discussion, let me say that the fact that you have experienced that allows us to have this discussion, because when I discuss it with people that haven't had the experience, they don't know what to say.
Right.
You know, they just simply don't know what to say. And I don't blame them. I mean, well, how would you know what is being talked about if you haven't had the experience? It's a conundrum.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the fact that you have had it is allowing us to have this discussion. Now, what was your question?
I was going to say,
how
do we go about
it? Yeah, well, there is a, it's funny because I stumbled on this exercise, or I was guided to it, one or the other. And at the time, it seemed so, made up, juvenile or something. But it's turned out to be the most profound practice I've ever stumbled on, so to speak. And that is to simply imagine yourself in meditation drawing love up from your heart, which is where it resides in the human frame. Anyways, it's everywhere because it's everything, but it's concentrated in the heart of each one of us. That is like the little pipe that's bringing the natural gas to the house. And then you turn on the tap.
That's a good way to put it.
And yeah, the natural gas flows. So to imagine yourself, you can use buckets, you can use a hose, or whatever you want to imagine is at work here. But imagine yourself drawing love up from your heart. Now, remembering that love is always in flow. You don't want to just draw it up from your heart and leave it there. You either send it around yourself, you circle it about yourself and completely drench yourself in love, which is always a good way to start. And then you send it out to the world so that it's flowing through you. And we experience it as it flows through us. Mm-hmm. Got to stop thinking of it as a solid thing or a quantity of sand, it's some kind of... It isn't that. It isn't like money in the bank, or you can't save love. It has to flow. So that's why they say, serve, share, blah, blah, blah. We're always flowing love out in that way. So first of all, we have to take into account the way love operates, right? And the way love operates is that it flows. And, it won't come to people who are focused on other things. You've heard it said, I, the Lord, am a jealous God. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want material possessions and that's chiefly what you're concerned about, love sits back and waits for you to come to your senses, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Doesn't flow in that kind of environment. You have to love, so to speak, for it to... You also have to recognize love. I've had three experiences now where I saw love, bliss, and peace as if they were people or objects or something over there. And I recognized them. And the minute I recognized them, they filled me up, took me over, so to speak.
Wow.
And let me just mention... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, when did that happen?
Yeah. It's all on the blog, so
okay.
all these experiences are on the blog, but a piece, I think it was about 2016, 17, bliss and love were both in 2015. I was almost the full year in transformative love and bliss. Those are the three majors. Also, abundance as a state. I've experienced abundance. Excuse me, not as a condition, not as having money, but the state that abundance is. And of course, it just led to love. It was another aspect of love. And the state of mastery. We talk about mastery the same way we talk about love, but I don't think many people realize that it's actually a state of consciousness. And I experienced that as well. And I didn't see where that led, but I presume it probably lead to love. You know, love is the end point.
It's pretty much the answer to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. One stop shopping. Yeah. Yeah. Which
it's like going to Walmart.
Yeah. I'm $55,000 in debt, right?
Wow.
And not only that, but it's separate debt. So it's not like you're paying one lump sum. You're paying quite a bit to each one of these people you owe, not people, but institutions you owe debt to. And so you'd think that I'd be knocked flat, right?
Right.
And it's only bringing up love from my heart, which keeps washing it clean, you know, and releasing me from the stress.
So would you say this is really all, you're being trained right now. Was that part of what's going on?
As we all are, yeah. But yes, I am being trained, yes.
So to deal with what you're dealing with is really part of your training, so you can serve in another way when the day comes, when more happens.
Yes.
It's all part of the way I look at it, too. Whenever I get pushed up against the wall, not financially maybe like you are, but stress-wise as far as overwhelming things, a lot of things happen. And I know it's always challenging me at the worst moment. Go do this, go do that, go do this. And it's like I'm thinking, oh, I'm tired, I want to go home. And it's like, okay, I said I was going to help somebody, so I'm going to help them. And then I'm always so grateful that I do take the time. You know, every time I think, oh, this is going to be the worst, I really don't want to do this, I don't. And then I have the most incredible time, and there's often some great gifts that come out of it. And that's what I know is that this training is going on with TJ so that he learns to be unconditional as much as possible.
Yes.
So
yes. Let me just mention, if I may, that light workers, geez, I can't remember what I was about to say. There are certain factors to being a light worker which are different from the general population. One is that we are, just as you say, being trained. And many of our circumstances are very, very difficult in order for us to see how it is for other people who live in that circumstance, like debt, for instance, or it could be illness. You know, everybody thinks I'm ill. It must be something I've done. Not necessarily. My mother-in-law was constantly ill. And Michael told me the reason she was that she had a sole contract before entering here that said that she would remain joyful no matter the circumstances. And she has. Mm. She never complains about her illnesses. Mm. She never talks about them. And she's perpetually joyful. So first of all, you know, like our circumstances are not necessarily karmic. And the second thing to remember about being a light worker is that the rest of the population could have enlightenment experiences and they'd be blowout. But if you're a light worker, those experiences could be truncated. They could be toned down, modulated, because light workers need to continue serving. So, for instance, just to give you an example, I had this experience of the self at a retreat center I was at, Xenia Retreat Center. And in the presence of the self, I felt innocent and pure and natural. But the light that the self is itself was simply luminescent. It wasn't brighter than 1,000 stars. And I was having a reading with the Divine Mother October 26th, and I said to her, you know, that light should have been brighter than 1,000 stars. And she said, oh, a million billion stars. And I said, it was truncated, wasn't it? And she said, oh, yes, indeed it was, yes. What did she say after that? She said, if it wasn't truncated, you'd have departed. And I said, well, wait a minute, Mother, that is just the fourth chakra experience. It's the first enlightenment. Why would I depart? And she said, well, I don't mean that you would die, but I do mean that you would go off by yourself and think, well, I don't need anything else. I'm all right, everybody. Good luck.
Right.
So she modulated it. So I just mentioned that to light workers who have an enlightenment experience and then say, well, wait a minute. You know, where was the bliss? You know, or I had a seventh chakra Brahmayana experience in which the Kundalini roared past me. I was lying down. It roared past me and went to the crown chakra, and that was that, right? But there was no bliss. And bliss is what elevates you, right? And allows you to connect with everything that's happening. So, again, Michael said, yes, that was truncated. We want you to keep both feet on the ground. So, do you follow what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Like, for light workers, it's a little different than for the general population.
They're going to turn off the sensors. It's like the light sensors that you have maybe on your house. So, when I step outside, or somebody else steps outside, oh, the light went on. But then when a light worker steps outside, oh, it barely went on. It's really dark. It's not working. I don't think it's working.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Somebody else walks out. Hey, it works fine. Look at that. What the heck is going on? I've got to go buy a new one now. So I know exactly what you're saying.
What's wrong with you?
And then also maybe the reverse of that or similar to that, another aspect, I guess I would say, is that in many instances, light workers are maybe in some ways being spared their lives, are even though if they're difficulty. I can name several times in my life where I could have been gone, you know, from incidents.
Yeah.
And I always feel, and we all maybe feel that somebody's protecting us, but I seem to notice it's like with light workers, maybe there's just a little more to... because that's probably what they chose, to have this protection around them.
It depends. All about the contract, right? All about the soul contract. So, for instance, I was about to, about 30 years ago, I was about to take a harmful substance. I did take it. And nothing happened, right?
Wow.
And I took three more doses of that harmful substance and nothing happened. Well, that would be enough to knock out anybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so 30 years later, I said to Michael, did you have anything to do with that? He said, oh, yes. We did not want you to get involved in that. So they do intervene. But light workers have a contract, so that's why they'd intervene more often with light workers,
right?
Because they're part of the plan, right?
Absolutely. It's not like anybody gets special treatment. You know, God has special treatment for light workers. The rest of you, sorry.
I'm okay.
Just kidding.
Screw you all. Yeah. No.
No, but I think, you know, it's part of our journey. And if we don't know, everybody's journey is different. So even sometimes what appears to be devastating for anyone, I look at it as, I just don't know what they signed up for, and I'll help them if I can, but also at the same time, there's a reason for everything that happens, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. And definitely. And also for light workers, you know, like the default for ordinary people is to say, I don't know what's going on, and I have bad luck, and blah, 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 bad karma, whatever. But I think light workers should first of all ask themselves, is there an aspect of service to this? Is this happening because I'm being asked to serve? If for instance, if I can't pay my bills, then I'm on my way back down to the downtown east side where rents are about, you know, $400, $500 a month or something. Very much less than what I'm paying now. And the advice probably for me would be stop thinking of it as if it's your bad luck. You know, we need you down there. You know, we need your vibration.
Yeah.
We need your light. A friend of mine said, why do I have to work in this damn hospital all the time? And I asked Michael Ford and he said, you know, she's thinking of it as if we should have her in a place that she's very, very happy with and comfortable. We have her in the hospital to bring her light to the hospital. So it's not about us. It's about our service.
Mm-hmm.
And light workers might want to look to that as their default. Why am I in this situation?
Can we change that situation at all, Steve?
That's a good question, TJ. I rather think that's up to them.
Don't we have the ultimate control to really create our own? I mean, we're creating while we're here, so we could pretty much create whatever we want, couldn't we?
That's a more senior truth than what I'm saying. Mine is service related, you know, this lifetime, but you're talking about a much more broader perspective. And yes, we do. In fact, I can give you an illustration of that. There was some talk about early ascension a few years back, and I said to Michael, "Can I ascend early?" And he said, "Well, it isn't according to the plan, but if you want, I'll come and sit with you and you can ascend early." And I said, "Well, no, if it's not part of the plan, then I don't want to do it." But there you see, I could have overruled the plan, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The
answer is yes then, right?
Yes. The individual does have the final say. It's a free will universe. But light workers have agreed to be part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so even when, I wonder if there's, here's kind of a thought too. I wonder if there's like a, you know, a second plan. So like we're here and we're frustrated and, you know, I don't want this anymore. And then before we came here, we said, you know, I'm going to say that a couple of times. Just ignore that. When I say that, just ignore it.
Yeah, that's right.
I want out of this. Yeah. I want something better. You know, I've written down right here on the plan, ignore my cries for help. Okay, thank you. Boom. And that's why, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go on. We were going to talk about the reval. Is that how you say it? The revaluation?
Yep, reval, yeah.
And so you're kind of the one that introduced me to it, and I've been looking into it more and following it more, but what is the reval? First of all, what is that all about?
Well, the reval is one among a number of financial alternatives the Company of Heaven has to redistributing wealth on this planet. Just to give you an idea, let me first say what the reval is. The reevaluation is a reevaluation of certain currencies. So at some point they're going to jump from what they are now to a radically different value. And the primary currencies in which this is happening are the Zimbabwean dollar, the Iraqi dinar, and the Vietnamese dong. Now, I don't know if you can buy Zimbabwean dollars anymore. You might be able to get them on eBay or Amazon, but my understanding was they aren't available. If they are available, they're very, very expensive. They also are the ones that will produce the most value. But the one that's most easily available is the Vietnamese dong, and it has the advantage of being on the current currency exchange boards, whereas the Zimbabwean dollar and the Iraqi dinar are not. And what that means is if you buy $300 worth of Vietnamese dong and you have waited long enough for the reval, you don't want to wait any more longer, you can take the dong back and get your value back. Same is not true for the Zim and the dinar. Now, this is a way of getting money to light workers, pardon me, and some other traditionally disadvantaged groups like Native Indians and veterans in order to refashion the world, really. I mean, I for my part, for instance, am going to be hosting universal basic incomes for a number of countries. I'm not only a part of the reval, but I'm a part of some other things, too. And so there's going to be a lot of money flowing. And other people are building treatment centers for women or fund, you know, one person wants to raise teachers' paychecks. She wants to send them an additional amount of money. Lots of health-related projects. Lots of relief for other countries. So that's the reval, but it's only one among a number of ways that wealth is going to be redistributed. Another one, you've seen President Trump bring in an executive order to sequester the wealth, the assets of people involved in serious human rights abuses. Well, that takes in most of the Illuminati. Murder is a significant human rights abuse, and as is war that has no defensive basis, or et cetera, et cetera. So all that money from all the Illuminati figures and the corrupt political figures and the corrupt entertainment figures and all of them, if they're guilty of significant human rights abuses, they've lost their money. And their money is taken before the charges are tried in court, right? It's sequestered before, right away. They wake up one morning, they have nothing. And that's to prevent them from simply, you know, burying it in the Antarctic or something. But so, then there are others, many other sources of wealth. So we can come to that later if you want to
talk about something. No, that's fine. I want you to keep going because this is all great information that I rarely get anybody on talking about. I know we talked about it a little bit and I've been looking at it. So there's really been a plan in motion by the Company of Heaven, by multidimensional beings, by Space Brothers, others, lots of beings, to help restore the wealth of the planet, to free us with technologies. This has all been kind of moving forward, right?
Yes, yes. The plan has been in existence for eons, but I think the other factor that people need to keep in mind when they think about the plan is that this is a free will planet. No one, you know, not even the Divine Mother will interfere with our free will. So, for instance, lately the Illuminati have gotten their mitts in the reval, and the Divine Mother won't interfere with that either. But what she does do is she advises us, hey, gang, if you raise your vibrations, you'll bring yourself out of the range in which the Illuminati can touch you. You know, they won't even be aware of what you're doing. So, you know, by us raising our vibrations or by us meditating en masse and these various things, it frees their hands, right? It's like, oh, there's another side that has free will that's asking us to do something about this. Well, in light of that, we can. You know what I'm saying?
Right. It's like the tipping scale, the tipping point. There's always what I've heard for years before I talked to you, Steve, is that we would receive this great awakening when enough people on the planet became aware. And I don't know what the number has to be, but it was a certain point of consciousness that once enough of us became part of that, then boom, it would spread like a wildfire. And there would be the great awareness. So kind of similar to what you're talking about here.
Well, yeah, but there are two aspects to that, TJ. One is that there's a tipping point for, say, ascension. And I think, in the individual, when you're over 50% clear, clean, pure, innocent, whatever, decent, I think decent is probably the best word, then that's the tipping point for ascension, right? But what you're really addressing is the, not quite the 100-monkey effect, but the fact that when it's more what you're addressing is called entrainment. At what point does the rest of the population fall into line? And that's been estimated to be a mere 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever. It's like somebody sets a new fashion, new way of wearing your jeans or something, slashed, we'll say, or whatever. Or you're wearing a tattoo. And when a certain number of people are, or maybe they're influential, then the whole of the population is busy cutting their genes or what have you.
Right.
So that's a trend, and that is what is generally called entrainment. That's a much lower number. So there are those two situations.
What you're saying is that we need a higher vibration number with a great number of people.
No, I think it'd be a lower number of people with a higher vibration.
Okay.
If you're talking about the reval,
The reval.
countering and transcending the Illuminati's influence. You know, I don't know what they did. Did they buy Zims, or, you know, I don't know what they did to get their mitts into the Reval, but it'd be a smaller number of financial wayshowers or light workers whose vibrations would need to be raised. The general population knows nothing about the Reval.
Yeah.
Or if they do, if they've heard about it, they say, oh, that's a scam.
Right.
By the way, let me just mention that Michael said to me, oh, a couple of years back, I think, that the Company of Heaven is not bound to release prosperity by the Reval. They can release prosperity to even the same people who are holding Zims through the Saint Germain World Trust. They don't have to go through the currency markets and, you know, all the arguments that are happening between finance ministers and presidents and blah 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 and whatever is happening. They don't have to do that. They can go through other mechanisms.
Do you think that?
Would you like?
Go ahead. Sorry? Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Would you like to hear about gold being brought from outer space?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Because this is another source of wealth, right? Other planets have gold. And Linda Dillon she bilocates every night, goes to the Neptune. And she was aboard the Neptune one night, and she watched the larger ships come into the Neptune, because the Neptune is something like 28 miles across or something. And they would come in, they would dock, they would unload their gold. And then she saw smaller ships going out, bringing the gold to Earth. So, I mean, even our star brothers and sisters are contributing. And the money for an alternate reval, which would involve the same people, so no one would lose out except the Illuminati, but it could come from interplanetary gold.
Hmm. And there will be enough for everybody. Everybody will have.
Oh, yes.
Because what we're talking about is it's a lot that, first of all, that these groups of Illuminati and families, they have trillions and trillions of dollars, don't they?
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah.
And so if you take some of their funds, I think none of us would ever have to really work again. Although I think, you know, what is going to become of us? Because we're going to need people to do things. So what's going to become of us when this goes forward?
Well, this is all going to be coordinated with technology from our star brothers and sisters, right? So, for instance, the typical one people focus on is, what about garbage collection? Well, we're going to have technologies that get rid of garbage at source, you know, like right here in the apartment or the house. Mm-hmm. We won't need to take the garbage out. But apart from that, I think I've been told that people will continue to work because they enjoy working. But what will change is that they'll work at something they want to work at.
And they won't be doing it for money.
They won't need to do it for money. Nobody will need to do it for money. So, no. No. And money will disappear at some point. We'll all just be sharing.
Right, absolutely.
At first, we have enough money. And so, you know, the whole thing about want disappears. So we calm down as a society. And before too long, we'll simply be exchanging, bartering.
This is what we're seeing with the millennials now, I think, is that they don't want to go work, and it's like it's because they know better. They know that this is not the enslavement.
Yeah,
it's like they don't want to be part of the enslavement. And maybe some of them are a little entitled, but also I think there's something that's saying to them, why am I doing this? The rest of us always went along and said, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm the little sheeple. I'm going to keep doing these things. And they're going, that doesn't make sense.
There are a lot of them that are doing that. I think there's also other factors. Excuse me a sec.
Are you still there, Steve, or are you coughing up a fur ball?
Oh, I forgot to take it off mute. So I think there are definitely, because the people born recently are said to be already ascended. They're more advanced than we are, so to speak. But there's other aspects of the economy to keep in mind. We have automated work in the last 20, 30 years. We eliminated entry-level jobs. We flattened the corporation. We eliminated, I said jobs. We also eliminated careers, professions. You know, all kinds of things have gone so that the modern company, well, the most you get in many modern companies is being a consultant. Whereas in my day, I had a benefits plan, I had permanent employment, so to speak. I had pension, but that's not, none of that's available. I see young people who are holding down so many jobs. You know,
I see that.
I can understand why they would be turned off by the modern economy. It has nothing, it holds nothing for them.
No, not like it used to. Companies used to take care of their people. And, you know, you can just see that there's a shift in consciousness. Even in a small town mentality, companies gave you health insurance. Of course, it was more affordable. Companies would throw a Christmas party. There's less and less of that going on, mainly because they think they just don't have to, which is fine by me.
Yeah.
Our company actually does hold a Christmas party. But the point is that I just see that there's less and less for the worker because they seem to have less and less value to the overall company.
Yeah, it's whatever you can get away with that people seem to do. In the 90s, I woke up to the impact of automation in the early 90s, and I then used to watch the discussion in the various business magazines, and it was all, don't let your competition eat your lunch. You know, eat them before they eat you. This country is a shark, and that country is clobbering us, and we're going to hit back. And, you know, it was all really low-density discussion. And in the face of that, companies, I think, felt able, you know, to cut back on everything, especially since automation made it a buyer's market for labor. You know, they could cut back on whatever they wanted, pensions, benefit plans. There was such a competition for jobs that the workers didn't have a leg to stand on. So that's the background to the younger generation being thoroughly disillusioned.
Yeah, and I think they also realize, why do we work our whole life, have very little free time if you're working a lot? And then also, you know, you go to college and you don't even know what you want. And you're told, well, take this degree. And how many people even wind up following whatever they got a degree in? And you get in the workplace and then you come to, we don't know what we want and we're thrust into something. It would be better to actually go and check it out first and try it on for a while and then go to college and go from where you want, so you know it's something you want. But if you ask me, Steve, if I had a choice, and I love what I do on the radio and I love doing the podcast, but if you gave me a choice of not having to do any of that, I'd take that choice. You know, doing
what
light work.
What would you do?
Well, I would do light work. I would help others. I'd still do a podcast. My goal would be to have many, many groups of people coming together from all over the world, speaking and talking about different things, reaching others. That's kind of a dream of mine. But then also I would travel to all these what I think are sacred places and maybe get together with other beings and just, I know people that are healers, so I would bring them in. There'd just be a lot of different things that I would do and with all the free time. And then I would slack a lot because I've been working my whole life since I've been 14. And so I think I'd do a fair amount of that out in nature, just enjoying it and getting back to whatever else needs to be done.
Well, when the whole factor of want and need and lack and all that is taken out of the equation, which is what the reval, and after that, something that's called NASARA, National Economic Security and Reformation Act, when that distributes wealth to everyone, not just people who hold currency, you know, all of that will go away. And when you want to go off in nature, you'll be able to.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be your own boss, so to speak. So it's all coming.
Wouldn't that be nice? The thought of that, not having to answer to anybody but yourself. And I think so many of us have been trained our whole life to
yes,
be
yes.
controlled by someone
but
else.
We tend to compartmentalize, right? We tend to think in this instance of the reval, and we think, you know, that I, in my ordinary state of mind, am going to go into the reval. But at the same time as the reval is happening, the energies on the planet are rising, so that our ability to love is increasing. So if you then take that, you know, I'm a more loving person, and you put it back into the reval focus, and I have all this money. Do you know what I'm saying? We begin to see a sort of a more integrated picture of how this is all going to work.
Well, eventually we would no longer probably want the money or need it. And if we continue, I don't know how long it's going to take to evolve to this state, but if we're getting too close to ascension, well, then we're going to be able to create things with
yes.
our thoughts. So eventually
yes.
none of this is going to be even necessary. I don't know
no.
how long that's going to be down the road, but I would assume that's
yes.
the next step.
Next step, yes. The higher dimensions don't work on time. You know, everything to them is in the present. So they can't really give us a time. I don't know how long it's going to take before that state is reached. But they have plans at every stage, right? So, for instance, before the time when we can create ourselves, they're going to make available to us things like replicators, which, you know, you think about what you want and it's there. And there actually have been instances of replicators on Earth before this time. And I'll give you one example. A Hindu holy man, Sri Satya Sai Baba, was said to have given four rishis who were meditating in Himalayan caves, what we call replicators, but what they called, I think, Kalpatri dishes. And a Kalpatri is a wish-fulfilling tree. And so here's this Kalpatri dish in their cave, and they would think of what they want. I want a hard-boiled egg, and it would be there. And I knew about that way back in 1980, I knew about the Kalpatri tree dishes. And it's exactly the same as the replicator.
That's interesting.
So he just had some earlier models.
Right. Well, and then how many times have we had the technology that, you know, we've kind of risen up and declined probably several times over the eons that we've been here?
Say again, I'm getting that twang again.
Well, let me turn it down just a little bit.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
you know, we've had this technology before. We've risen up and then also fallen so many different times throughout our history.
Written up and then fallen so many times in our history.
We've risen up. And yeah, with technology.
You know, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes, yes. That's true. Yes, yes. Various times.
Those inventions were already here maybe millions of years ago or thousands of years ago.
Yep.
And we've just kind of forgotten technology that's already existed.
Yeah, the only historical event that I'm aware of that I've been able to get some knowledge on is in 1200 BC, many Mediterranean civilizations collapsed. And the explanation for that is that something called the Sea People came along and defeated, you know, these empires, Hittite, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, etc. But we just have no records of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Michael, what happened in 1200 BC that caused the civilizations to collapse? And he said in around that time, the Earth civilizations made it clear by their feeling states and what have you that they no longer valued the participation of the Star Brothers and Sisters. And so the various galactic civilizations decided that this was the time for them to pull out and allow Earth to continue on its own. So they pulled out, you know, you see Göbekli Tepe and, even the Egyptian pyramids, for heaven's sakes, and all these.
Every culture.
Yeah, every culture has influence, has traces of the influence of the galactics. they pulled out in 1200 BC. The civilizations immediately started to try to conquer each other and had incessant war from that time on. I mean, as a historian, I've looked at the matter, right? And it was simply war from you know, every century from that point on. And here you see us, you know, with nuclear bombs, and we're still making war, and on the verge of annihilating the planet. It's like we never stopped in the whole time, except right now. So that's the only event that I'm aware of that I can actually tack on to the galactic influence. The others are all archaeological evidence and mostly suggestive, you know, but I regard Michael as saying that as being something I can accept as probably true.
You know, and absolutely. And I agree with you on that, because there, I don't know if you watch, I don't know if you catch any TV, but the Ancient Aliens.
I don't have one.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a program called Ancient Aliens, and they're always talking about these beings that were here. And some say, well, they never left, but I think they did leave. And why did they leave? And they left around the time period about 1,000 years ago or so. Maybe some didn't quite leave at that point. Maybe some have been coming and going. But that was always the question I had. And why would they leave if they're here helping us? And maybe not all of them were, but most of them were helping us. What made them just go, you know what? And it's because we no longer wanted their help. Let's put it, I guess that's.
Yeah, we didn't value them. Yeah, we kind of, I don't know exactly. Sorry.
I was just going to say that makes a lot of sense. And I've also heard that from other sources, what you said exactly. So it rings very true.
If you ever do hear, you know, do get me the quote, because I find that particular thing very interesting, you know, that they did leave. You see flying saucers among the hieroglyphs, you know, and there's all kinds of indications that that they were here and were helping the civilizations.
And if you...
Go ahead. Well, I had a past life in Atlantis where I was a person that received visiting diplomats and kind of made them feel at home and shepherded them through their meetings and such. And so there we are in Atlantis, right? What's that, 13,000 years ago or 26?
I can't. At least, yeah, it's, there are reports that Atlantis went down somewhere around 10,000, 12,000 years ago. That,
okay, so yeah, so 13,000 years ago. There's Atlantis freely interacting with other galactic civilizations. And I think we both know that Hindu literature is full of discussions of extraterrestrial vehicles and weapons, and they're given funny names, but they still were from off this planet. So, and I think everything that lies ahead is gradually staged. Like there's this time of the reval, and then replicators and med beds and things like that get introduced.
Do you know? And I know we've talked about the reval before, but and people say it's coming, and I know people are impatient. But what is your feeling on that? Where we stand on that right now? Because you said there's been some interference with it. What are you feeling?
I think, are you still there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I can. The twang effect is quite pronounced.
The twang is back. Can you hear me any better now? Is it any better now?
No, it's no good.
It's not good right now.
No, I hear every second or third word.
Maybe I should talk really slow?
I don't know. I've never encountered this before. So,
well, I can edit some of this out if necessary, but maybe we should wrap it up then. Is there anything more you'd like to say, Steve?
I just want to underline that, you know, it's been said 100 times. I know people are tired of hearing it, and because we don't experience higher dimensional, we don't know why people are talking about it. You know, it's like, oh God, here he goes on about love again. But it is. It is, in fact, the answer. It you know, never mind how many times you've heard it discussed. Not the ordinary love that we feel now. That's not what they're talking about. But this more refined kind of love is definitely the answer. So everything anybody can do to cleanse themselves of their issues, you know, to get over it, get finished with it, process it, give it to God, whatever they do to emerge from underneath this blanket of issues and begin the flow of love from their heart out into the world, that's the most important thing that I can think of, TJ.
That's how we can make a difference.
Yes. Absolutely. Totally.
Well, I appreciate you coming on my program again.
It's always a pleasure. And I have the most enjoyable conversation with you that I can think of anywhere. So
thank you so much.
Really enjoy it. Yes.